This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Alex Higley.
And I'm Lindsay Hunter.
And I'm a writer.
But... Welcome to I'm a Writer, But. Today we have Christina Cook. Christina Cook's writing has previously appeared in Prism International, The Caribbean Writer, Prairie Schooner, Epiphany, a literary journal, and elsewhere. A McDowell Fellow and 2022 Journey Prize winner, she holds a Master of Arts degree from the University of New Brunswick and a Master of Fine Arts degree from the Iowa Writers Workshop. Born in Jamaica, Christina is now a Canadian citizen who lives and writes in New York City. And today she's going to talk to us about her debut novel, which has yet to come out, Broad Upsy, which follows a young woman as she travels from Canada to her native Jamaica to spread her younger brother's ashes and reconnect with her estranged sister, a trip that forces her to confront being gay in a deeply religious family as she muddles through the aftermath of lost love and meets a brash stripper who shows her a new side of Kingston. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
This is going to be fun. You. Alex and I, as we were saying earlier, we've yet to talk to a writer who is sort of on the cusp like you are, like extremely accomplished. Your book is going to come out at some point and you're in this like wonderful space right now where it's just like really fun, I hope.
No, I'm going to say I have been enjoying every millisecond of it. This has been something that feels very hard won. I've actually been working on this novel on and off for the past 11 years. Wow. Don't quote me on that. I'm not good at math. I do verbs. I don't do numbers. But it's been a minute. And so to finally be in this space where this project that I've incubated, honed, crafted, rewritten, for it to, you know, be on the cusp of being in readers' hands is something, you know, when something is a dream for so long that it starts to feel like it'll only ever be a dream.
Oh my gosh.
That's kind of the space I've been in for a long time.
Oh my gosh. That's amazing. Yeah. When does it officially come out? Do you know?
I don't know the exact day yet, but it's coming out in January of 2024.
Oh, that's very exciting. Well, we're so happy that you're here with us, and we would love if you would read a little bit of Broad Upsy.
Sure. So I always feel like the best place to start is at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to read the first few pages for you all.
Excellent.
1996, Monday. Sara and I walk through the hospital doors, up and around the large staircase as I recite the nurse's directions in my head. Take the hallway on the left, then another on the right, straight through the waiting room to a row of patient rooms, then turn, the first on the right. There he'll be. And there he is. My brother's hospital room smells like air conditioning and antiseptic and the musty stench of something decayed. I glance up at the far corner, afraid I'll see a muted TV and black smoke gathering above green trees, like I saw the last time I was in a hospital, when I was 9 and my mother was dead. Hey, my baby brother Bryson says, smiling up at me from his bed. Hi, I whisper. He coughs, heavy, threatening, on the brink of something nasty. My father looks in from the hallway as my girlfriend Sarah hands him a tissue. Here you are, she says. Bryson's face spreads into a wide grin. Ye are, long drawl rolling easy in a familiar caress. He was 2 when we moved to Texas, only 6 when we left for Canada. He knows he's Jamaican. He knows what it says on his birth certificate. But there's something about slow-smoked brisket and fruit paletas and screaming hook'em from football bleachers that makes him feel like he's where he belongs. How y'all doing? He says, then coughs again, his small body convulsing. Akua, my father calls from the door, gesturing for me to join him in the hallway. But I don't move. I can't stop staring at my brother, watching the slow blink of his eyes and the way he squirms under the stiff sheets, IV lines pulsing red in and out of his sallow skin. He shouldn't be here. He's only 12 years old. We'll be right back, Champ, Sarah says, ushering me out of the room. Out in the hallway, the doctor extends his hand to me, his head cocked at just the right angle to seem concerned. I'm sorry about all this, he says. I stare at the gray hairs on his knuckles, my own hands limp at my sides, then make my way toward a seat. Daddy takes the doctor's hands and shakes it as Sara heads down the hall to give us space. Now that we're all here, the doctor says, looking from my father to me, Bryson's sickness, it's hereditary, passed down from parent to child just like eye shape and skin color. Daddy looks at his knees. Is there a history of sickle cell in your family? The doctor says. Any extreme anemias, blood-borne illnesses? I watch through the small window as my brother coughs, his body retching with our mother's disease. Daddy buries his head in his hands. My assistant will be with you shortly, the doctor says. She'll explain all the information we need to help you through this difficult time. Sarah looks at me longingly from the other end of the hall. She heard enough. She knows. I stay where I am, heavy as lead. Tuesday. I flip the quarter between my forefinger and thumb, as I stare at the gray payphone hanging on its hook. Behind me, I hear machines beeping and nurses shuffling in and out of rooms. I have to do it. I have to call. Sliding the coin into the machine, I dial my sister's number. I know, my older sister Tamika says as she picks up. Daddy called me this morning. When does your flight get in? I rest my forehead against the booth's cool wall. She says nothing, her breath coming quick like she's struggling for air. Tamika? Daddy didn't tell you, she says. Tell me what? I squeeze the phone. Are you sick too? I go dizzy for a moment, knees threatening to give. No, she says. Praise be, I'm fine. I exhale, relieved. Then what? She goes quiet again, scratching sounds filling the receiver like she's fiddling with the cord. I'm not coming, she says. I can't come. What? I wrap the phone cord around my wrist. A nurse rushes past, a clipboard under his arm. I'm sorry, what? I say again. Tamika stays silent as the nurse knocks on the door, then lets himself in. He's sick, Tamika, I exclaim. You hearing me? He's sick. I know, she says. Can I talk to him? Why can't you come? She goes quiet again, static feeling the phone pop, 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 then clears. Tamika? Nothing. Tamika, you can't be serious. The phone line remains silent. She has nothing more to say. I unwrap the phone cord, then stare at the crisscrosses of pulsing red on my skin. Are you serious right now? I yell. She sighs. Why are you always like this? I don't know why, but I laugh. Our brother's sick in the hospital and she isn't coming, so I laugh and laugh and then I hang up. I pick up the phone, dial tone beeping, and I hang up again and again, laughter rolling up my throat like fizz from a shaken soda. And I hang up again and again, smashing the receiver against the metal clip harder and again, until Sara wrenches the phone out of my hand then pulls me away. Shh, she says, as she wraps her arms around me, but I will not cry. I will not be soothed. I push her away. Akua, she hisses, as I march down the hall to my brother's room. Slamming the door behind me, I pull a chair over to his bed. He looks up. I am here. He smiles. I am where I should be. I will not leave. I will not be known to my brother only through the phone. Running my hands over my braids, I force my face into a smile. Hands trembling and ball tight, I want to grab his lunch tray. I want to watch it smash against the far wall. Our sister isn't coming. Eat your jello, I mumble, pushing the tray closer to him. The food here sucks, he says. Don't they have any enchiladas or taquitos? He curls his hand into an O, then stares at the empty space between fingers and palm. I know what he's thinking. Scrambled eggs and melted cheese seeping through toasted tortilla, fresh and steaming as it wafts around the school courtyard. You remember Dave, he says, wiggling his fingers as they bunch and grasp at nothing at all. This one time, Bryson says, me and Dave, we bought too many taquitos at recess. Daddy had just given me my allowance, so we bought too many and I saved some for lunch. He closes his hand into a fist. Cold taquitos are gross. I shrug. Should have made Dave pay for them. I sit down next to his bed. Then they would have been his problem. But that's mean, Bryson says. But you would have had hot and free taquitos. He chuckles as he picks up the small cup from his lunch tray, watching the green square jiggle in his hand. Eat, I urge him. He slips a chunk of the green square in his mouth, chewing slowly, then swallowing. See? I squeeze his knee. Not so bad. He makes a face, pretending to puke, as Daddy comes into the room. Tamika should be here soon, Daddy says. She's coming? I exclaim. Daddy looks at Bryson and says to his son, her flight's been delayed, but don't worry, she'll be here. Bryson puts his jello down with a soft smile. He hasn't seen our sister since Texas, when he was 2. I grab my father's arm. Is she really coming? What are you going to say to your big sister, he says to Bryson, when she arrives? Bryson thinks for a moment, fiddling with his gown. I'm going to say, sister, if you were in a burning car, who would you call? Batman or Superman? Daddy laughs. I dig my nails into the cotton off his sleeve. Is she really coming? Such a smart boy may have, Daddy says. Bryson tries to laugh, but his laugh turns into a cough. Closing his eyes, he sinks into his pillow. He's breathing harder than he was before, air gurgling slow through his open mouth. I let my father's arm go. She'll be so glad to see you, I mumble to Bryson. Daddy looks at me. Yes, she will. Will she cook with us? Bryson says, trying to sit up. Does she like to eat? Bryson loves to eat. He marks his days in meals, memories cataloged by the sensations on his tongue. Of course she loves to eat, I exclaim, leaning over Bryson and giving him a big, big smile. Soon as we get home, we're going to whip up enough cheeseburger and enchiladas. Enchiladas, Bryson exclaims as Daddy chuckles, and brisket, and rice and peas, and curry chicken, but without the potatoes. I hate potatoes. Lord boy, Daddy says, tucking the sheets under his body. You go eat yourself sick. Bryson smiles, closing his eyes. I think I need a nap, he says, having worn himself out from saying so much. You do that, little chef. I lean over and kiss his forehead, his skin sweaty yet cold. Daddy fixes his pillow as I tuck the sheets under his hips. Bryson touches my arm. You'll be here when I wake up, right? I'll fight anyone who tries to make me leave. The doctor knocks lightly on the door. A word, he says. Daddy and I follow him out the room. Down the hall, Sara sits, throwing me a small smile, then a wave. Blinking fast, I look away. It's a long shot, the doctor says, rubbing his chin and handing over the forms. But we're running out of options. The illness is progressing quickly. It's worth taking a look. Daddy nods, signing the forms, then handing them to me. He doesn't read them, doesn't need to read them. He's been signing forms and sending Bryson and me to tests in hospitals since I was 10. The test should have caught this. I flip through the pages and pages of fine print, trying to take it all in. Just sign, Daddy says, sounding tired. Through the shut door, I can hear Bryson coughing, fever getting worse. Are you all of Bryson's next of kin? The doctor says. If there are other family members, it'd be ideal if we could test them too. I can't come, Tamika had said. But now our brother is dying, and there's me wanting my big sister. What a idiot child. As I sign, I press the pen against the paper so hard that it starts to rip. Our sister is in Kingston, delayed by a plane that will never land. I watch my brother through the small room window, breathing shallow as he tosses in his sleep. I hope he's dreaming of his sister sprinting through the airport, of her waving down the plane with her voice rising and arms flailing as she throws her suitcase, throws her whole body, doing whatever it takes to stop the plane so she can climb on and come to him. Great, the doctor says, watching me sign. My assistant will walk into the lab to get the blood work started. Who knows? One of you might be carrying just the thing we need. A nurse enters Bryson's room, introducing herself with a curt smile as she replaces one of the pouches hanging over his bed. Inserting the new needle into his IV line, she squeezes the pouch to start the flow. Drip, drip, Bryson's blood goes. Drip, drip, like counting seconds, losing time. Thank you.
I guess one where I wanted to start is, what was the initial impulse with this novel? And I know it's a completely unfair question, but that's not going to stop me from asking. I know it's been, you said, you know, 11 years, a long time that you've been working on and off on what is now Brought Up Sea, but what was the original impetus and jump into the work?
For sure. Well, what I can say is that I wrote kind of the first sections of this novel, thinking it was going to be a short story collection.
Wow.
You know, all writers start out thinking they're a short story writer, and then they realize that they are or they aren't.
Right.
And it was during my first master's at the University of New Brunswick. And I remember doing a bit of research at the time, and I found three things. One, I found books that were about being a woman in Jamaica. Two, books about being gay in Jamaica. And then three, books about being a straight Jamaican who now lives abroad. But I found almost no novels, no work of fiction that intersected all three of those lines. Mm. And then same thing, basically nothing about a Jamaican who's been living abroad and makes a decision to go home.
Mm.
So I wanted to kind of explore that, but I didn't want to explore it in this way that felt like I didn't want to intellectualize it, because so much of what that experience means lives in the body. It lives in people experiences and how it can heighten or complicate relationships. And so I specifically wanted to look at it through fiction, right? Through family through love.
I love that you made such a it's such a pragmatic way into a project, it sounds like. You know, it's like, okay, I have examples of A, B, and C here, but nothing where they all blend. And yet the actual endeavor, fiction, as you're saying, is just like such a mess and such a difficult and arduous way to, I don't know. It's just, I love the disjunction between the very pragmatic decision and then what you were actually doing. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And especially like holding it to, you know, what you were saying, like examining it through family and love and place, because place is a big part of it as well. And I want to know, like, how, because 11 years, you know, like, how did you keep yourself in it for 11 years? You know, how did you keep the flame alive as you were going?
Well, I, in both like what I read and what I write, I'm very character driven. Like, I fall in love with people more than I fall in love with what happens to them. Like, you know, both are important, absolutely, for a piece of fiction to work. But for me, if I don't feel like I can crawl up and get inside of the character, it's never gonna click. And so the thing that really kept me going, because at so many points I tried to stop. I tried to be like, well, it's been 4 years. That's it. Going in the towel. And truly the thing that kept calling me back was Akua, was this character. I kept hearing her voice in my head. And so I think, you know, a huge part of the journey to publication, the journey to Brautopsy as it stands now, was truly me kind of accruing the skills necessary in order to actually do Akua's story justice, being able to like properly render it on the page. Because I think like I had a grand vision all those years ago, but I did not know how to execute it. Mm-hmm. And so that's been a lot of trial and error, a lot of like muddy messiness, like what you were saying, Alex, a lot of just like feeling through. But my North Star was always this voice. Like, she was always crystal clear to me, even in moments where I wasn't clear on what to do with her.
So was this part of like what you were working on at Iowa? I know you it worked is. On it at McDowell. Okay.
Oh my God. Okay. So here's like the crazy story. Okay. So I started working on it during my first master's. I wrote some of the sections that you all saw in like the flash in the flashbacks of her as a child in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. Those are the stories that I wrote thinking that it was a Shaw story collection. I wrote it and then I was like, that's it. I did it. Done. Moving on. And then I came up with this separate, what I thought was a separate idea for, a novel that would be about a Jamaican going home, whereas the Shaw story collection is about a Jamaican in Jamaica. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was working on in my years at Iowa. And it actually wasn't until I finished Iowa and I was showing the novel to a friend of mine who had also read the Shaw story collection, who she was just like, you've been writing the same story this whole time.
Wow. Oh my goodness. God.
These are all part of the same thing, same universe. It's just, you know, this part is the head and this part is the tail. Now stitch them all together.
That's a good friend to have.
Yeah, really.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. You know, that friend who when something is going wrong, they're not the first person you call because they're going to tell you the truth. Yeah. But really what you want is someone to tell you that you're right.
Oh, my God. Oh yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
So then you get out of Iowa, you have your friend who is gently nudging you in a different direction with the project. You rewrite. And then Are you seeking different editorial voices at that point for the project, or do you go back to that same friend? How did you kind of navigate that middle period? And were you already represented at this point, or were you still kind of feeling your way through the project before seeking representation?
I was represented, not by my current agent, but by a lovely woman who I had a, you know, wonderful rapport with.
Sure.
Who was very supportive and really prompted me to kind of write into the in-between spaces. Because as you can imagine, you know, a Shaw Story collection, I mean, you're going for consistency in thematics, consistency in place, you know, like that. Those are like the larger things tying it together. But those don't have to explicitly be on the page because they're individual stories. So there were lots of kind of like gaps that she was very instrumental in kind of pushing me towards filling.
Mm-hmm.
And then it honestly became like a big lesson on figuring out the structure. I think that is the thing that I struggled with the most and is the thing that will probably always be my Achilles heel, because I tend to kind of like develop story according to and like emotional intuition.
Mm-hmm.
But that emotional intuition, unless you create handholds, only makes sense to me.
Mm.
And so a lot of what I did in that kind of like intermission session was trying to think, okay, what is the like external scaffolding that I can put around this character and her story to have her mean as much to the strangers on the street as she means to me?
Mm. It's so interesting to hear you say that, Christina, because the thing that has struck me about the portions of the novel that I've read and then just hearing you read tonight is there is a directness and clarity to your prose. And it seems like that often is a natural, is paired easily with, you know, structure, plot in that. But it's so funny that the internal experience of that, however the writing may feel to a reader or register with a reader, it really has no bearing on the internal experience of the writer developing and drafting that work. It's so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's awful. To everyone listening, don't become a writer. It's torturous. It's I would not recommend it. Yeah.
Do you mean that?
Yes and no. Like
it's not for everyone.
I think that everyone should have some kind of a creative practice in order to better like release whatever is happening on the inside, to better understand themselves, to better be in touch with them, with mm-hmm. themselves. But in terms of, do I think everyone should become a capital W writer? I don't know, if I'm honest.
Oh, I agree with you completely. No, I absolutely agree.
I think the capital W writers are the ones who keep showing up, as yeah. you were for Akua. You know, like it's yes. someone who just can't help themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's someone who spends 11 years writing a novel that's going to come out on Catapult in January 2024,
that's right.
You know, excuse me.
But it's funny because I think for a lot of people, it, you know, some people, the wild thing, looking back on my own MFA experience, the thing that is so strange to me is the number of people who got that degree and either do not write anymore or seemed almost immediately to abandon that aspect of their creative work, which mm-hmm. I am not saying with judgment, because I think mm-hmm. for a lot of for a ton of people, and I think this kind of gets to what you were saying, Christina, potentially, and I know we weren't talking specifically about MFA programs, but going through that experience, I think clarifies for many people that writing is actually something they don't want to do.
Yeah.
But the thing that I wish more programs included would be stories like yours, Christina. And I could include myself in that too, because,
you know, let's restart this whole podcast and talk just about that. Cause I can go for hours.
Please.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean,
that's the majority of people out there, I would say.
But you know,
the majority of people who are willing to even do that. You know, my experience is actually very similar to Christina's in a lot of ways, in that if you take away my first two books, which do exist, but exist on very, very, very small presses, no advance, no representation for either one of them. And if I would have just held out for, you know, getting an agent for the first project that was to come out, it would have been 11 years too. Mm-hmm. But I decided to take a different route to get my work to readers, and it worked out great for me. I love where I'm at now, but I was willing to do that. And a lot of people are not willing to do that. A lot of people are unwilling to say, okay, well, I'm not going to publish with this really small press because for me, it's actually about the book deal, or for me, it's actually about their recognition. And I'm going on and on. I want to hear your thoughts on this, Christina.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, looking back on it now, I'm actually really grateful for all the ways in which I was forced to like grow up through this kind of 11-year process. Cause like I have two things to say. One, my partner is also a writer, and we talk often about how, you know, the industry kind of props up talent. You know, the industry loves nothing more than like a wonder kid. Mm-hmm. But so much of being a writer is about tenacity, right? About having the stamina to sit your butt down in that seat and be like, I feel like crap today. These are going to be terrible sentences, but you have to do it. You have to keep going. Mm-hmm. While at the same time recognizing that you also have to keep living your life. Like when I think about so much of, you know, what made me maturate to the point where I had the skills in order to like, you know, write the thing that needed saying, like to say all those truths like you were talking about, Alex, it's because I, you know, moved to New York, to New York City. I met my partner, I fell in love, I, you know, switched jobs three times. And through all of that, like I never stopped writing. Like you have to find a way to kind of do both.
Isn't that, you know, Alex and I started this podcast where we wanted to talk about all that other stuff. and we inevitably end up talking about the writing because it's the thing that we are all like, you know, struggling to do and so devoted to. Mm-hmm. But really all that other stuff
is so key.
It is. And it's a huge portion of your day, you know?
It is.
And you're either, you know, fighting through it, enjoying it, using it in your work, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, your life is happening as you're making this thing and remaking it. And it's, you know, it's intertwined, you know, it's part of all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I, you know, it, to go back to the point that you were bringing up earlier, Alex, you know, I've seen kind of two things, especially in my cohort out of Iowa, of same thing of people coming out and seemingly, you know, I don't know if they're, you know, writing for themselves, but seemingly have just stopped at least publicly producing their writing. Or people who kind of stopped their lives because they were so intent on getting that book deal, which is wild to me. And I'm not saying that with any kind of judgment, you know, on either, but it's just, it really speaks to how just insane and strange and unpredictable and like unbalanced and maybe a little bit unhealthy like the writer's life can be. And I think this is part of why I don't advocate it for everybody, because I want other people to be happy, you know.
It really is. It's like a constant struggle for, everyone loves the word balance, but like, and it's, you know, That's the wrong word, really. Yeah. It's, mm-hmm. you know, a constant struggle for, I don't know, paying the amount of attention you want to pay to things at the mm-hmm. right times.
Mm-hmm. And really, I think, and this is true for myself, so I'll say it that way, because I don't think it's true for everybody. But the only way I ever get a long project done, the only way I have to this point, is to become obsessed with it to the mm-hmm. point of, to the detriment of other parts of my life, or
yes.
potentially been in a pocket of my life that was different. I haven't done a residency, but you know, like not the most recent book, but the book before that, I just was like, you know what? All right. I'm not drinking for a couple months and I'm not going to do anything social. I'm just going to finish this. And that's yep. what I did. And that would be impossible in my life now, but at the time it was very possible. And mm-hmm. we all get, you know, no matter how crazy your life is, there are these blips where you get opportunities and you can choose to see them as opportunities, or you can choose to just continue on, I think, sometimes. And they're not always easy to recognize, but otherwise I don't know how people get it done.
It's mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Like you have to like become a little bit crazed, you mm-hmm. know, in order to like actuate the wisdom and truth and beauty, like the real essence of the thing that you're chasing. Cause that's really what we're doing. Like we're chasing either like a feeling or a truth or an experience or a perspective through words, through these things that are like such slight approximations mm-hmm. of the kind of dynamism and dimensionality of the thing that we believe in, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can't be a writer unless you believe, like mm-hmm. in whatever the thing might be.
Yes.
Right. And but then like, but as you both know, when you truly believe like the fervor of it, like the fugue state that it puts you in, mm-hmm. and then trying to put that on the page, like you have to become obsessed, you know? And so that kind of, it's a thing that my partner and I talk about often, of we at once like abhor other writers, you know, because writers are like terrible people. While at the same time, we're both really grateful for each other. Mm-hmm. You know, like when mm-hmm. she's just like, "Baby, I can't walk the dog. I can't make dinner. I can't do laundry. I can only work on this scene." I'll be like, "I get it," you know. Oh. And that's what we do. Just you know, God help us if there's ever a time when like we both are obsessed with a project, and I don't know who's gonna walk the dog, but you know,
the dog's gonna walk himself.
basically
it's so funny because I think in romantic relationships it's either that, what you described, Christina, you know, whether or not your partner is a writer or even a maker, an artist, it's someone who's, you know, it's either someone who's very supportive and very aware of the process that's happening, or in my case it's basically like, yeah, that's fine, you can do that, I am not going to acknowledge that anything's happening at all, so you can absolutely take care of those issues and move on to the next thing. But God, I was trying to be funny with that, but it actually just came out, I mean,
I was like, oof,
yeah, grim. No, I mean, we'll throw in, you know, we have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old, so my little make-em-ups are not a high priority. Yeah.
Oh my God. No, I was just gonna say, sometimes it's nice because I'm also married to someone who's not a writer, not a maker. Sometimes it's nice to have someone not in that world, because I get sick of it.
Yes. Can we talk about that? Yes. Oh my God.
Nice to kind of look around and go, you know, like I'll talk to my husband about something in the publishing industry and he'll be like, "What?"
Yeah. You know?
Like, what are you talking about?
And then you're like, "Oh, right. There's a whole other world yes. outside of this."
Exactly. Exactly. And he's like, you know, he's very interested, you know, and like he dips his toe. A huge reader, a voracious reader, but like, you know, I'll be talking about something that to him is just like bizarre, you know? And it's like, mm-hmm. kind of just nice to be like, yeah, there's like a whole world
yeah. out there. Yeah, that's something that like my partner and I talk about often. About we're going through this phase now where we love our writer friends. If you're listening to this, we think you're all great. We adore you. But we're also just being like, we need some not writer friends. You know, we're just like we in, do you know what? We need more friends who are chefs. You know, more friends
Yes,
who are
exactly.
construction workers.
Yes.
Just because it starts to feel like you're in a fishbowl, you know? And then it becomes an echo chamber. It kind of has the same feeling to me as, I don't know if this is the same for you, for like either of you, but I was so relieved when I kind of moved. I was grateful for the experience of my MFA, but was also really relieved to leave it when it was done. Simply because, you know, I know that we mentioned this earlier, but this myth, right, that the industry props up for, as we know, for book sales and blah 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 blah, off like the 22-year-old who writes the Pulitzer Prize nominated, and there was a 12 house bidding war, and it sold for $8 million, and it's going to be a movie tomorrow. Like,
Yeah, and then you
right?
read it and it's fine, you know? And you're like, why?
But like that, like just there's so much fervor, like industry fervor around that narrative, that you feel like a loser, like a massive loser if you don't do that. And you start to feel like, what am I doing wrong? Is my writing not good enough? And like I don't know if anyone has like really researched this, of like how much of you know, the people who go to masters and then like stop writing, or like stop at least publicly writing, has to do with us kind of like eating our own, you know?
For sure. Yes.
You know, because it takes just like you like what like what like what I was saying earlier, to just become so crazed and obsessed that even though, you know, you feel like, oh, you're not, you here I am past 30 and I haven't sold my book yet, the industry is not going to love me, you know, but yet you keep going. I don't, like, what do you even call, I guess you call that tenacity and stamina.
You call it
Some
actually being a writer, like you're actually doing the thing, you know?
Exactly. And that's the thing, like I really want, and this is the thing which is why like I opened with it, I want to be very loud and intentional about the fact that it took, am I allowed to curse, it took
Yes, yes.
a fucking long time, and that's normal.
That
Like,
is normal.
you know, like I'm friends with Angie Cruz, where Dominicana took 7 years, like, you know, most of her books took like upwards of 5 years to reach the world. You know, Clavis, 16 years working on her debut novel. You know, my partner's working on a novel right now. She's on year nine. Like, it's
Oh my
just,
gosh.
but like no one talks about it, and I wish they would.
No, it's such a good point, and it also just is, it makes me so interested in all the ebbs and flows of how you kind of got to the point where you are. And the one aspect of your route to publication that is so interesting is you had a number of, you know, Iowa, obviously very prestigious, and then McDowell. When I was reading your bio, Christina, I was like, God, this is maybe an odd question, but did you feel pressure at McDowell not having a book out yet? Did it feel like, oh my God, everyone here is like ahead, or was there a kind of inherent pressure, or was it much more support? Was it a much more supportive and welcoming space than that?
You know, I really have to say my time at McDowell was magical.
That's so cool.
Magical in the sense that while I was there, you know, I was surrounded, A, because it's cross disciplinary, it's not just all writers, which is really cool. So it's painters and composers and singers, you know. So it becomes like a cross pollination of creative ideas. And then in the specific cohort, because obviously, you know, so much of your experience is impacted by who else is there with you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had a great cohort while I was there that ran the full gamut from, you know, from people who had never even done a master's, who were self-taught writers and had published nothing, all the way up to people who were Stegner fellows and people who, you know, had published, you know, debut books to huge acclaim. And the thing that was lovely is that across everyone that I met, there was a shared feeling of just being like, oh, why do we do this? And so we all just bonded over that. And I'll also be quite honest, you know, I was this way at Irwin and I was this way at McDowell, where I was just like, this kind of like dedicated time to work on my fiction is a gift. And I'm going to take advantage of every millisecond of this gift.
Mm-hmm.
So I also was really antisocial. So maybe I'm not the person to ask.
I want to ask about all the life stuff that's happening, you know, in addition to all the MFA and the McDowell. I want to, you know, because you have such an interesting teaching background and now no longer teaching background. I want to hear about that.
For sure. So I'll give like a quick little overview of my CV, if you will. So I was an adjunct professor starting in Canada at the University of New Brunswick. Then I taught at the University of Iowa for 2 years. Then I taught at Fordham, FIT, the School of Art Design in Chicago briefly. City Tech also in the city, and I'm missing somebody out. Yep, I'm definitely missing one institution, and I did that for about 7 years. And I started to feel very much about teaching how I feel about the industry, about the publishing industry, which is that I love the act of teaching, right? Of actually being in the classroom with the students and delving into the literature at hand, because so much of it is that the delving into the literature is just a vehicle for the forming of consciousnesses, which I think is a process that I'll probably always be fascinated by and obsessed with. And so I loved that, but all the other stuff of academia, I could really do without. And
did you find you were able to write while you were?
No, teaching? That was okay. The next thing I was actually about to say is that, so there was like, I loved teaching, but especially as I started to kind of teach higher level classes, it started to use the same energy and the same part of my brain that I use for my writing. And so I kind of hit this point where I realized I could either be a great teacher or I could continue on my kind of never-ending quest to be a great writer. And it was kind of heartbreaking, and I had a whole meltdown about it, being like, I'm not adequate, blah blah blah, other people can do this, why can't I, of just being like, I had to choose. I couldn't do both, and I chose the writing, I chose the art, and for a very long time after I felt quite guilty about that choice. You know, but the thing that I tell myself now is whenever this book comes out, I'm not writing anything for a long ass time. I'm gonna sit my ass down. I'm gonna read other people's books and I'm gonna just, you know, put the pen away.
Oh, and, yes.
And then I can always just teach then, you know, just to go back to that question of balance. Of just being like, balance sometimes mean that there's a time for this and a time for that. You don't have to do everything all at once.
That's really hard to accept and remind yourself of. It is because that pressure is always there, you know, and especially going back to what you were saying, being in the writing world that we're in, it can create a kind of derangement, you know, I think maybe it was Jack Gems was talking about, you know, it's useful to remember, like, yes, some people might be having these amazing things and, excuse me, you might start thinking to yourself, well, why don't I have that? And it's useful to step back and go, well, am I willing to do that kind of work to get the thing that these people have? And if the answer is yes, then do the work. But often it might be no, you know?
It's also so hard sometimes, I think, with close friends, or maybe, you know, it's a first reader of yours or someone you went to school with. It can be really easy to just like conflate someone else's success with your lack of success, or like
all the time,
just like, just to like take in some of there's no relationship between these things so often. I mean, always. And yet I think so often it's like, it's hard to realize, okay, that person's experience has literally nothing to do with me. The fact that I either read their work or they're a friend of mine or whatever it may be, it has nothing to do with your own writing. It's a completely separate venture. I don't know.
And this is really where I credit, you know, like I mentioned before, just like continuing to live your life and through that process, you end up with wins in other buckets, you know, which helps to kind of have like a more even foundation and like multiple pillars upon which you can define success. You know, like for me, I'm like I'm a disgustingly hopeless romantic. And so to me, you know, finding someone with whom I could partner for life was a massive success. Like that is huge to me. And so, but like having that while the book was not done and, you know, not selling at the same time, like it balanced it made it easier to deal with all the difficulties of the writing once you feel as though like other things in your life are going well.
My husband will say, like, you know, I have a great family. I have a great wife. We've been together almost, you know, 20 years, great home. We live in a wonderful city, but I'm a massive loser. He says it, you know, jokingly, but it's funny because it's like all these wonderful things, but I'm a loser. And sometimes as a writer, you know, you can kind of, it kind of puts things in perspective. Like you're saying, you have the love of your life, you know, you live where you want to live, you know, like but sometimes you'll be like, but, you know, so-and-so got a TV deal or whatever.
Then also, you know, I think it's also important to highlight the ways in which getting other things in your life makes the writing possible. Like I truly credit so much of me being able to like actually understand, not just objectively, but like inside my own brain, understand structure with having to do with getting a non-teaching job as a project manager.
Whoa, where that's so interesting.
So much of what I do is being like, all right, this client, you know, here we are at point A and we got to get them to point B. And it's my job to figure out the process of how to get there.
Wow.
Right? To come up with the spreadsheets of like what needs to happen when to, you know, do kind of like air traffic control between different people on the team. And that's what structure is, right?
Oh, yes.
Structure is like, I have this character and I want them to arrive at this meaning. How are you going to do that? You know?
I think it's similar. We talk sometimes about how having kids has made us more efficient when we have time to write. Before there'd be a lot of like wheels spinning or like anxiety.
Oh, yeah. I spent hours on Instagram, like you just totally. my screen time when I'm writing is through the roof.
Yes, absolutely. And like now, like we'll have an hour, and so it's like I gotta fit 1,000 words into an hour or whatever it is, mm-hmm. you know, and you become like ready, you know, mm-hmm. like, I will sit down and I will do the work because it's literally all the time I have.
Mm-hmm.
Funny how life shapes those things for you.
True.
Yeah.
So Christina, then the actual process of the book going on sub, did that happen? Was that like late 2021 when you actually had a version of Brought Upsy that you were like, all right, I'm set. I'm ready to go out with this representation.
Man.
You felt good about what was, tell us about your,
I love an answer that starts with, oh man,
me too, because honestly, if your answer to this question didn't start with, oh man, and it was about going on sub during the pandemic, I wouldn't believe you.
So I'll give the fuller answer. I should really come up with like a more concise way to discuss all of this.
No.
That's for future me.
Right.
But also kind of like the best. So you know what? No, I just love it. Here we are in the mess. Is that this book went out on sub in different iterations over the span of 4 years.
Whoa.
Oh my God. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I think I got 72 rejections.
Oh.
Yeah. That sounds
about
right.
A real number. God. Holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah. It was interesting. And again, like I kind of described that whole process as living through an excruciating ego death.
Why am I laughing? That's terrible.
Because you're laughing because you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Lindsay, because we've both had our egos destroyed by submission,
murdered, annihilated,
like done for. Which I was grateful for in the end, because then it made me it made me actually get to the bottom, like get beyond the, you know, inherited narratives, the stars in my eyes, to be like, okay, what do I actually want mm-hmm. for the life of this novel? Mm-hmm. Right. And it's through that process that I kind of realized that if I was going to fail, I was going to fail on my terms. Wow. So being very clear about what the book was and being crystal clear about what the book was not, and what are certain lines that I am willing to negotiate on and what I'm not willing to negotiate on. And that was, it took me on a very interesting journey. I'm trying to think through some of the reactions. Oh, I think my favorite reaction to the novel was, which I just took it as a compliment to just how vivid and how real I can make a character feel, is that someone, an editor who said no, said because it read like a memoir.
Wow.
And I was just like, well, it's because it just feels so real that you think this must be a real person. Surely this is not fiction.
Yeah, no, what a strange. Yeah, exactly. God.
You know, yeah. Like this is too much like a memoir. Like it actually feels real.
Yeah. So I think by the time that I was with my current agent and she was sending it out, I was much more at peace about it. You know, like I wasn't obsessively checking my email anymore. I was sort of like, if it sells, it sells. And if it doesn't, this was still a worthwhile project.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So take solace in that, kids. That's the maturity that 11 years will bring you.
Oh, we were talking to someone recently and it was like, I thought I was the only one who had gotten rejected so many times on sub. I think it was Andrew Bombeck.
It was Andy, yeah.
Listening to I'm a Writer But really showed me how wrong I was. And it's like, that's great. That's exactly why we exist.
I mean, honestly, if the only thing that this podcast does is let people who have not yet gone through submission or querying for an agent or even just receiving edits during that process just lets them know kind of what to expect, then I think that it's worth having this podcast, even though even though it takes up so much time, I still think just even that's enough, because I really didn't know any of that, even right. coming out of an MFA. I had no idea how hard any of that stuff was. I was just mm-hmm. like, you know, eventually I'm going to have a book that's so good that they're not going to be able to say no. Like, that's mm-hmm. just how it's going to work. What a fucking asshole I was to think yeah. that. So stupid.
It's a miracle. Getting a book published is a miracle.
It is.
Yeah.
Someone, I think it was Stacey Austin Egan, was just telling me she spoke to some editor who said that they read 1,000 books a year and they buy 8 to 12.
Oh my God.
You know, that's what we're dealing with. And
yeah,
it's a miracle. Like, we should all be proud of ourselves.
It's true.
Yeah. Yeah, it's part of why, like, I truly try to caution people against getting caught up being like, I want my book to be published by publishing house X. And I'm just like, just if you get published, period, be happy. Mm-hmm. You know, like, don't.
That's true.
It's so true. And I feel like I went into, I was very ignorant. And I in some ways, I remain very ignorant. And I think it helps me not have expectations that I shouldn't be having, mm-hmm. because I honestly didn't know. I never would have been like, well, I prefer this publisher to this publisher because XYZ, or they published. I just didn't know any of that stuff, you know.
But you know what, Lindsay, as you're saying that, and actually what Christina just said kind of triggered this for me, where, you know, to get published anywhere is amazing. You and I shared this, Lindsay, in that, you know, early on, the fact that Zach was like, yeah, no, like, give me whatever you got. We'll put it together. We'll make a book.
Yeah.
Like, that right there, the fact that you were just like, yes, that is the important thing. Because absolutely. If that doesn't happen, if the Featherproof projects don't happen, then FSG absolutely does not happen.
That's and exactly
if,
right.
And if it's my first 100%, and if my first two books don't happen on the very small presses, there's no way I would have a novel coming out. Mm-hmm. It's just, there's different paths to it, but if you have an opportunity to publish your work and you turn your nose up at it, I think very often it's not the right move. I just think that it's okay to take different paths to get wherever you want to go.
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about that with Deborah Shapiro, who just self-published her novel.
Yeah, right.
After having two novels on bigger houses, and you know, at a certain point, it's like kind of like what you decided, Christina. It's like, I want this book out in the world, and I want it on my terms.
Yeah.
And I'll compromise on this thing, but I won't on this other stuff, you know? And it's like, I made a thing that I want people to have. Mm-hmm. So I'm mm-hmm. going to do that.
Yeah. And the thing that's important for people to keep in mind as well is that book publishing is not a one and done deal. Like, you don't just like publish one book and then it's like, this is your only shot. Like, it's a marathon, not a sprint. And so, you know, to like what you were saying, Alex, like, there's like, your first two books were absolutely foundational to you even being on this podcast. I mean, to like you being in the position that you're in now, right? Mm-hmm. And same thing, like, you know, me and the one master's and then the other, and thinking I was writing a short story collection, but then it was really a novel, and then two novels, having to put all of that had to happen to get to where I am now. And then this step has to happen for wherever it is that I'm going to go next.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
No, it is. And so
if you went to yourself 11 years ago and said, it's going to take 11 years to do this, it would have overwhelmed you, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But just keeping present and keeping yourself taking these steps, these important steps that you're not entirely sure where they're leading, but they're keeping you in the work, is mm-hmm. everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And to just keep improving in whatever that looks like for you.
Right.
You know, which just means putting in the work.
Put in the work.
Well, Christina, thank you so much for joining us tonight. This was a especially fun one because we don't really get to catch authors at this moment very often. And it's also fun because we're going to be able to cheer for you in January and of 2024 and say, we talked to her when we were
she was on I'm a Writer.
She was on. We got her first. And
thank you.
Really appreciate you taking the time to spend an hour with us tonight.
And I appreciate you both for having me on.
This was awesome. What a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
That was good.
That was so fun. Good.
It's so funny too, because like as we were talking, I was like, this is good stuff for many people to hear. And it's so easy to stray into like aphorisms and cliche, but when I'm saying a lot of these things, I truly mean them with all my heart. Just that, like, I remember getting advice. I remember listening to an interview with Shane Jones, and I've told him this. He's a friend now, but I told him, hearing him say in an interview that the only way to finish a novel, or he, no, 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 it was much more low key than that. And that's why it actually was inspiring. He said, you know, if you're obsessed with writing a novel, like if it's all you think about, eventually you're just going to write a novel. You will. And I remember hearing that and thinking, oh, okay, well, I'm definitely fucking obsessed with writing a novel. So I think I'll be all right. And it was just so calming to me to hear that. And so I think so often some of these things that you and I maybe say behind the scenes, or it's like even some of it even veers into like self-talk in a way, you know, I think sometimes it's good to have an episode where we're saying a lot of that out loud.
Absolutely. And Michael Wayne Hampton was messaging me on Instagram.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And he was like, I would really love to hear like your near misses or your failures. Like, I'd love to hear more about that. And I was like, you know, I feel like we talk about it all the time, but maybe what we don't talk about is the anguish and like the absolute doubt and like fear, sadness, you know, that we feel as all of this is happening.
Right.
And cause I was like, you know, I feel like Alex and I have talked a lot about going out on submission and getting rejection. And
I know, I feel like we talk about it all the time, but you're right. You're right. Maybe we don't
talk about how hard, like emotionally it is. I mean, like absolute devastation. And like, just not knowing what's next. And like, honestly, like I'll try this on when things like this happen. I'll try on like, well, that was it for me. It was a good run, you know, like my life is now this other thing, you know? Yeah. And then I think like Christina said, you inevitably either you go back to the work or you don't. And right. I have always gone back to the work because it's the only way I feel better.
Yeah. Well, and you are kind of a particularly interesting example in regards to this, because when you got some feedback on the novel three novels ago at this point, your instinct was to completely strip the thing down, rewrite it, and then write another novel.
Yeah.
I do remember that you were really down. I mean, you were like, but then you moved through it. I mean, you moved through it quickly. I mean,
I guess like to be like, I don't know. I feel like I've said this, but you know, it was my editor at FSG who wasn't able to buy the book for FSG, not because she didn't want to. Right. And then she left FSG. And so it felt like a complete unmooring, and that it's totally normal. I'm sorry. I have the cough. Totally normal for an editor to move on or pass. Actually, on your...
more normal than not at this point for them to keep moving, honestly.
Yeah. But I just felt like I was just like, wow, I'm a loser. And you just have to, not because of anything she said. I mean, she was wonderful all through it, but
yeah,
it's the voices in your head.
Mm-hmm.
It's your sales numbers. Honestly, it's my sales numbers, which are terrible. I have still not earned out my advance on Eat Only When You're Hungry. So if anyone's wanting to help a lady out, please go buy that book.
Come on, what are you doing? What are you doing, people?
Please help me.
Yeah. I don't know. I know that I leaned on friends big time when I was on submission this last time. I leaned on you a ton, on our friend Emily a lot, our friend Adam. I mean, just people who have gone through this, and because you really, it makes you so nuts. It makes you question whether you can do the thing at all.
Yeah.
And that I think is the crazy making part when you're getting these, and Luke talked about this on the most recent episode, you know, just how it doesn't matter how close you are, a no is a no. And I think there is something that's so damning about that. And it's hard to even move on from it in some ways, even once you, I mean, the situation I'm in now, I wouldn't trade for anyone, but I still, it's like, wow. Yeah. That was gnarly as fuck.
It's so, I can just remember just like it hitting me at odd moments and just being like, oh my God, you know, like I had a chance to like capitalize on my career and I failed. And like, you know, like, oh my God, why did I believe in this book? You know? Right. And like, why didn't I shoot higher or whatever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But you just have to write the book you're writing.
Yeah, exactly. That's really it. That is kind of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're sick. Let's not do this anymore.
All I was going to say is I had the pleasure of being edited by Alex on a project we're working on that I'm really excited about.
I'm really excited about it too, actually. I think the story you wrote is just a fucking knockout. It feels like a classic Lindsay story in a way. Like it feels like that kind of like classic propulsive Lindsay Hunter story that we all have fallen in love with before. And yet it's brand new, and that's thrilling.
Thank you. I just wanted, like, I felt like, I don't know, maybe it's because we're friends, siblings at this point, but like I just felt like I could, I knew, like, you were asking me for things. And I could see what you were asking for, and I totally trust you. And it's because I know you, and I, you know, like, I know what kind of reader you are, and it's just awesome to know what kind of an editor you are now.
I appreciate that. It was so fun to do it. I mean,
it was a joy. I mean, I don't know if you still have openings for your editing, but like, if anyone's looking for an editor, my next thing I'm sending to you, because I just felt like,
I appreciate that.
You know, like, writers know what I'm talking about. Like, you want someone to be straight with you, and you want someone to level with you, and you want someone to push you. And I felt like you were doing all of those things at the same time as like helping me be me.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's easy to do when you love the work, and you know that too, having done lots of editing yourself. It's when you love it, when you love what you're reading and it's great work in front of you, it's not work, it's pure pleasure. So that was great, and I can't wait for people to see it.
Me too.
We can tease it. I mean, let's just say it.
You know, it's what gonna... actually, this episode comes out in November. It's so, guys, well, we're talking about the back. Britney Spears story.
Yeah, the Britney Spears story that is going to be, or that is, on WordRest Review, and it's going to be the first publication of WordRest Review, which
I'm
is
so
just
excited.
Unreal. And the art that David showed us, and the way that they're going to present it on the website is just outstanding.
Yeah, like, what a crew. Like, David Byron Queen.
Oh, man. He's
Alex,
the best.
Colin Winnett. and, like, I don't know. Go follow WordRest Review and just die over it, because it's amazing. And I'm so honored.
Did an amazing job. Yeah, it's going to be great. I'm excited for people to see it.
All right, I'm going to go cough some more.
I know, I'm sorry you're not feeling good, but I know that you're just going to feel this way for the rest of your life, because that's what's been happening to you now.
Yeah, it's kids, you know. I'll feel like this until they're in college.
And then you'll visit them at college, and, you know, same thing.
Yeah. All right.
All right, bud. Have a good night. See ya. We did it.
I'm a Writer But is recorded by Alex Higley and me, Lindsay Hunter, in our respective basements. Editing by Lindsay Hunter. Music by Max Loop. Yeah, yeah.